Hi there, it's Virginia from Word of Mouth. You know what the best part of this story is? It was here when you were ready to listen to it. Radio on demand. Right now, we need you to be here for us because your financial support is what keeps it all going.
Word of Mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Ian Morris is not the only historian to propose that geography enabled Western culture to flourish and eventually dominate the world. Jared Diamond popularized that theory in his best-selling book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. Morris is, however, the first to quantify those advantages by tracking key social developments of societies over 15,000 years. By plotting changes back to the Ice Age, Morris pulls the lens way back to observe the shape of history, if you will, based more on biology and geography than individual human agency. Morris made that argument in his 2010 book, Why the West Rules for Now, that studying these patterns reveals clues not only about human history, but its future. His most recent book, Measure of Civilization, makes calculations about humanity's future in ways that tend to make scholars bristle. Those same predictions have made Ian Morris very interesting to another sector of the intelligentsia, the CIA, which invited him to Langley to conduct a seminar. So why was a Stanford professor of history and classics their pick for a briefing?
Well, yeah, it was a really interesting day out. There's a group as part of the CIA called the National Intelligence Council. Every 4 years, right after the national elections, when the new president comes into the White House, the National Intelligence Council presents him or her with its global trends report, they call it. It's kind of looking forward into the future, asking where the world is going to be going. And the latest one that was finished in 2012, this was the Global Trends 2030 report. So what they do when they're preparing to write this report is they bring in a series of people who've been doing research, looking at the big trends that are sort of guiding where the world is going. And so this is something I'd been working on, kind of trying to look at very long-term history, going back all the way to the end of the Ice Age, about 15,000 years ago, to see if we could draw out what the big trends in history have been. And then, of course, if you are successful at doing that, when you've identified these things, you can perhaps begin to ask where these trends are going to take us next.
Well, your book, Why the West Rules for Now, from 2010, and your new book, Measure of Civilization, are looking back through that history. And I guess if I can sum it up in my understanding, it's that geography determines a great deal about how and when regions develop. And you begin with the geography that helped shape the West in the Fertile Crescent. Can you bring us through a little bit of what the advantage there was?
Yeah, well, this is a way of looking at history that kind of came to me while I was writing the book. I didn't start off with a preconception that geography drives everything. It's just that the more I looked at the big scale history, the more this seemed to be behind all the big patterns. I think what it really comes down to, you know, one of the big things we've learned in the last 100 years has been just how similar people are all over the world. And so if the people are pretty much the same all over the world, then we have to find some other explanation for why societies have turned out in such different ways around the world. One of the things that I felt that I learned from writing these books was that the societies they create are also kind of similar. The people want the same kinds of things. Societies tend to develop along different paths. But what makes the difference between the different parts of the world is just that the people are in these different environments. Say, at the end of the Ice Age, 15,000 years ago, the world begins to warm up. And in certain places, plants and animals have evolved that people are able to domesticate and to become farmers. And so if you live, it's basically a band of latitudes in the old world, stretching from the Mediterranean over to China. And if you live in that part of the world, it's much easier to start domesticating plants and animals and being a farmer than it is anywhere else in the world. Like, say, if you live in Siberia, you're just never going to be able to become a farmer by yourself because these plants and animals aren't there. But at the same time, the way the societies develop drive what the geography means. And so as societies become more complex and organized, whole new sets of things become important. Like, say, where I grew up in England, through most of history, England is this horrible backward place stuck out on the edge, poking out into the Atlantic. There's nothing much going on there. But by about 1500 AD, societies have developed so much, you're getting ships now that can sail all over the world. And all of a sudden, being stuck out into the Atlantic like England did starts to become this huge advantage. So you get this back and forth through history between the geography and the development.
Well, one of the things, the innovations that you have done is to create this kind of social development index. I think that's what it's called. Tell us a little bit about what you are charting, in fact, in the social development index.
I realized when I started trying to write these books that a lot of the arguments among the specialists were really coming down to us not knowing what the patterns are that we're trying to explain. People would get, you know, furiously angry with each other over details, and it turned out in the end that often they were just defining all their terms in very different ways. So I tried to design this index which would allow us to measure how well societies do at kind of mastering their environments and getting what they want out of the world. And so to measure that, then what you need is, first of all, things that can be measured, and then they have to be things that can be measured all the way back, going a really long time into history. But to make the index work, I boil it down to four big things that I look at, which were the level of energy per person that's being captured from the world around you. If you don't capture energy, of course, you just die. If you don't capture lots of energy, you can't have things like cities and highways and radio shows and all these sorts of things. Then I also looked at levels of organization, and I used the size of cities as a very rough way to measure the level of organization in a society over time. The third of the things I looked at was information technology. You know, how skilled are societies at tabulating and controlling and spreading information and storing information? And then the last thing, sort of sadly last but not least, is war-making capacity. It's the societies that can't fight and defend themselves get taken over by ones that can do that. So I tried to figure out ways to measure these four things and then put them together into this numerical index that we could chart the big shape of development over the last 15,000 years.
I want to go to that last point. There is a term that you use about the evolution of war, productive war. How is war productive?
Yeah, this, again, this is an idea that kind of spun off from the writing I've been doing for my last couple of books. I'm now writing a new book about the history of war. It's going to be called War, What Is It Good For? Like in the song. Because the thing that really surprised me as I started looking over this long history is that war has been one of the big productive forces in the history of humanity. And what I mean by this is societies have changed hugely over the last 15,000 years. And one of the things that is we're now realizing that I think we hadn't realized until quite recently is that the world is a much safer place nowadays than it used to be back in the Stone Age. This just sounds kind of counterintuitive. You watch the news, it's all full of disasters and people getting killed and so on. But in Stone Age societies, your chance of being killed, dying violently, was somewhere between 10 and 20% in all the cases we can document well. If you look at modern times, like the 20th century, we have two world wars, genocides, nuclear weapons get used. Your chance of dying violently if you lived in the 20th century was just 1 to 2%, a tenfold fall in the risk of dying violently as the population's got bigger and bigger and bigger. We've gotten safer and safer. And the weird thing, though, as I look back over this history of how this had happened, the weird thing is there's a great paradox behind it, that what has made the world safer is actually violence. The world has gotten safer because we've got bigger and bigger societies have formed, which get pacified internally so that you can't just go around killing your neighbors if they annoy you, because somebody will stop you from doing that. But the only way we've been able to create these bigger societies has been through war. Either one society conquers another, or one society, out of fear of being conquered, starts to organize a bigger group to defend itself. The whole of history, really, is driven by this really peculiar paradox. And that's why I say sometimes we can think of war in certain circumstances as being a productive force. And what it produces is larger, safer societies that are also richer societies.
We're speaking with Ian Morris. He's professor of classics and of history at Stanford University. And he's the author of several books, including Why the West Rules, For Now, and his most recent book, Measure of Civilization. Well, Professor Morris, I want to go back to that point that I started with. You were speaking to this group at the CIA about to prepare a presidential report on where we're going as a society. Where are we going? Can you tell us what you told the CIA?
Yes, sure. Yeah, I think...
We won't have to kill you?
I think we've discussed that thoroughly, and they decided I could live this time. With this sort of index that I developed to measure how society's developed over a very long run of history, I think there's two things you can do with it if you're interested about where the world might be going next. And one is just to look at the patterns and identify the trends and project them forward and say, you know, what will happen if things continue to develop as they have been doing over the past, you know, many, many centuries. What that shows you, I think, is two big things. One is that the eastern parts of the world, East Asia in particular, are catching up on the western parts of the world, and by the end of the 21st century, other things being equal, they will have caught up. The second thing you see by projecting the trends forward is just how much social development will increase across the 21st century if the 20th century trends and rates of change continue. If the 21st century continues to change as rapidly as the 20th century did, we're likely to see as much development, as much change in our societies over the next 50 years or so as we've seen in the whole time from the end of the Ice Age to now. I mean, the world is speeding up in this mind-boggling way. And that's a pretty extraordinary thing. Mm. But then the other side of it, the other big thing you can learn from having a numerical index is saying, well, okay, that's all very well about what will happen if the trends continue into the future. But what is the likelihood that they won't continue into the future? You know, can we look back at the past and see what kind of forces disrupt these trends and change the way societies are developing? And I think we can. And I think the alarming thing about doing this is that the sort of forces in the past that have derailed social development and caused great collapses, these forces are very visible in the 21st century again. Mass migration is one of them. Huge epidemic diseases is another one. The collapse of governments, yet another. Food shortages and famine is the fourth of them. Then the fifth of them that we see over and over again in the past, always woven into the story somewhere, is climate change. And of course, all five of these are things that, you know, if you read in weekly news magazines or listen to NPR, you will have heard people going on about these as forces that we're increasingly worrying about in the 21st century. So what I was able to say to them was that I think there's two potential tracks we could be heading down. One is toward a world that's just very hard to imagine. Things are changing so fast, it's hard to see where we might go. The other is toward a world where we have another massive collapse, like the fall of the Roman Empire, say, but much, much worse.
The massive collapse of the Roman Empire was just a regional collapse. And one of the things that we found from the financial collapse of a couple of years ago is that we're globally linked. So it looks like, if that holds true, a massive scale disaster.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, this is why I think you're potentially one of the tracks open to us in the 21st century is way worse than anything that's ever happened before. I mean, like you say, the fall of the Roman Empire, the fall of the Han Dynasty in China around the same time, very, very big, but they are regional. What we then see playing out over the next 1,500 years or so after these collapses is, of course, you know, a recovery of development. Societies return to the same kind of level they were at in Roman and Han times, and even go beyond it. And the really scary thing now, I think, is that the world is so tightly tied together that it's like we've just got one big global experiment rather than a number of regional ones. This time around, if we mess it up, potentially we don't get a second chance to do this. I mean, the potential forces of destruction out there are so scary that we could destroy ourselves altogether.
Well, you've been looking at 15,000 years of development. Any way to manage this breakneck speed of development or change in a way that can benefit or learn from what we've lived through already?
Yes, I think when you look back at the earlier examples of huge collapses, the sort of forces that caused the collapse of the Roman Empire, or the sort of forces 1,500 years before that that caused the collapse of the great ancient Bronze Age civilizations, these are things that we could now deal with really easily. We're just so much better at dealing with things. But of course, the problem is that as our societies get more sophisticated, the sort of problems we're facing get more sophisticated as well. I will say at the end of the Roman Empire, disease is one of the big problems. And they had these great new diseases that spread and over the course of several decades wipe out big slices of the population. Nowadays, the disease is spread much, much faster than they did in Roman times. And say something like the SARS epidemic, when that began initially in South China, Southeast Asia, this spreads around the world in the space of a few days, so much faster than any disease has spread before. But at the same time, we're able to sequence the SARS virus and figure out its molecular structure and come up with solutions to it in the space of a few days. So I think the 21st century is going to be kind of a race between our ability to handle these problems and the speed at which the problems themselves mutate. I've got to say, I'm actually quite an optimist. I would say, although it's hard to find real evidence to prove this, I would say that the chances are we are going to manage them and that we will be able to cope with the problems that come up.
So an optimist.
Yes, I think so.
Well, can I just share with you, Ian Morris, one of the my absolute favorite comments on your books, theories, ideas of many that I looked at comes from someone posting under the name Fizmath, who wrote, "I might buy his book just because he tried to join Iron Maiden." What's the story here?
Going back deep into my past, when I was younger, I wasn't totally sure I wanted to be a historian or an archaeologist or any of these things. I was interested in all kinds of different career paths. And one of the ones I was most interested in was heavy metal. And so I played guitar in heavy metal bands for a long time and was convinced this is what I was going to do for my career. But it turned out that I wasn't as good at being a heavy metal guitarist as I thought I was. And I did apply to join Iron Maiden at one point. This is back at the end of the 1970s when they were looking for a new guitarist. And I was so confused and naive at that point that I actually thought they were offering me a position in the band. It turned out they were not even coming close to doing that. Yeah, that career line didn't work out. And I discovered that my skills are more suited to doing what I now do.
You wouldn't be the first to overestimate your ability as a guitarist, I'm guessing.
No, I don't think so.
I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thanks very much for having me on the show.
Ian Morris is professor of classics and of history at Stanford University. He's also a fellow of the Stanford Archaeology Center. He's published several books. We talked today about why the West rules for now, and his most recent book, a new book, Measure of Civilization. We have much more on the book and on Professor Morris at wordofmouthradio.org.